headlines. Iran says the IAEA will have no access to information on Iran's new nuclear site until the Vienna talks on removal of sanctions reach a final conclusion. Yemen warns the United Arab Emirates against continuing its aggression, saying that it will endanger the UAE's economy and investments in the country. And 13 U.S. states, two Latin American nations, support Mexico's lawsuit accusing U.S. gun makers of facilitating the trafficking of weapons to drug cartels. And welcome to our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran says the International Atomic Energy Agency will not have access to information on the country's new nuclear site until the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Iran's permanent representative to the agency says the IAEA will not have access to footage from cameras installed in the facility unless an agreement is reached in Vienna. Mohammad Reza Ghaibi says Iran has transferred its centrifuge parts production to from Karaj and has informed the IAEA about the move. According to Ghaibi, the centrifuge parts will be produced in Isfahan instead of the TESA facility in Karaj. The decision came after that complex was hit by a sabotage attack in June, which was condemned by the agency. Local commentator David Yaobian says the IAEA and the other signatories to the 2015 agreement need to meet their obligations under the deal in order to get information about Iran's nuclear program.
Iran is maintaining consistency with the agreement, with the JCPOA, with United Nations Resolution 2231, which under Article 36 enables Iran to curtail some of its commitments, those that it selects under the agreement, if other signatories fall out of compliance with their commitments. Clearly, after May of 2018, when Donald Trump unilaterally pulled the United States out of the agreement, the United States failed to live up to its obligations under the agreement, and this opened up the path via Article 36 for Iran to begin to curtail some of its commitments. Regarding this specific issue of the cameras in the new Isfahan site, this is very straightforward. If the IAEA or other signatories of the agreement and potentially the United States, if it comes back into accord, seek the non-proliferation architecture to be put back in place, and for example, for the cameras to be turned on in Isfahan, then they need to meet their obligations under the agreement by verifiably dropping all of the sanctions that have been levied against Iran.
Moving on, Sana'a has warned the United Arab Emirates against continuing its aggression against Yemeni people. The head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council says persisting in military action, blockade, and efforts to occupy Yemeni territories will endanger the UAE's economy and investments in the country. Mahdi al-Mashhad says the recent missile and drone attacks deep inside the UAE demonstrate the Yemeni army's resolve in delivering on its warnings. A Yemeni official insists that the U.S. and Israel cannot protect the aggressors from such retaliatory attacks. The UAE is part of a Saudi-led coalition which has been waging a deadly war on Yemen and keeping it under a crippling blockade since 2015. One of the Saudi-led airstrikes on Sana'a targeted an area near a television building in the city's Al-Tawara district in the early hours of Tuesday. And activist and political commentator Hussein Al-Bukhaiti says the Yemeni army will press ahead with its retaliatory strikes on Saudi Arabia and the UAE until they end their aggression against Yemen.
And I believe that the latest attack on United Arab Emirates is a clear proof that Yemeni army is well equipped to target United Arab Emirates. And I believe that in the coming days, if not hours, there will be a major attack against United Arab Emirates and as well against Saudi Arabia and Expo in Dubai. It could be as well a target. But I'm sure that Yemeni army, they will step up their attack because the Yemeni blood is not cheap and it should meet with the heart attack and wider attack against Saudi and United Arab Emirates as well.
Meanwhile, the Yemeni health sector is on the verge of collapse due to years-long Saudi aggression against the country. This has prompted workers in that sector to gather in a protest rally in the capital, Sana'a, to warn that many health facilities may stop working due to the lack of fuel. Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more.
Yemeni health workers have staged a demonstration inside the Ministry of Health in Yemen's capital, Sana'a, to warn that over 300 health facilities are on the verge of collapse due to the severe fuel shortage. They slammed the continued detention of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
The health sector is suffering greatly due to the lack of fuel, as health officials suffer from a shortage in electrical power generations to save the lives of thousands of patients. Intensive care units, oxygen factories, operation rooms, emergency rooms, and other divisions will stop, and this is a crime against the Yemeni people. Unfortunately, the international community remains silent about what is happening. The United Nations has failed to fulfill its duties.
The Ministry of Health has called on the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels and save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients who may lose their lives as a result of the Saudi blockade on the country.
Banning the entry of fuel ships and piracy on Yemeni oil ships lead to a health catastrophe, as hospitals and health centers are in constant need of fuel. The interruption means that health services will stop working. Some patients come from other governorates to get treatment in Sana'a, such as cancer patients, and the fuel crisis will make their transportation even more difficult. We warn of an imminent health disaster and call on the international community to do its part to save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children.
Recently, the member of Yemen's negotiating delegation, Abdul Malik al-Hajri, passed away of kidney failure as he could not travel abroad for treatment due to the continued closure of Sana'a International Airport that comes as Saudi Arabia and its allies have imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015.
The lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, are in danger amid the absence of essential health care services. Unfortunately, the inaction of the international community towards the catastrophic situation in Yemen is emboldening the Saudi-led coalition to further continue its crimes in the war-ravaged country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Moving on, Oman's foreign minister has visited the Syrian capital, Damascus, for talks with top Syrian officials on mutual and regional issues. Muhammad Ali reports.
Omani foreign minister Badr al-Busaidi met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. The two sides discussed bilateral relations and recent regional developments. During the talks, Assad referred to both countries' mutual understanding of regional issues, asserting that Arabs need to conduct realistic dialogue and set up necessary bases for political relations among each other. He stressed that developments in the Arab world require a change of their political approach. For his part, Busaidi conveyed to Assad greetings of the Omani Sultan, underlining Syria's strong and brave stances in facing regional challenges.
We look forward to strengthen our economic, trade, and political relations. I discussed in detail such relations with my Syrian counterpart. There are efforts made by many countries currently to bring Arabs together, correct mistakes of the past, and adopt a more futuristic vision for Arab cooperation in order to overcome the past.
For his part, Syrian Foreign Minister underlined the significance of collaboration with Oman for bringing Arabs together.
The meeting was an opportunity to discuss joint Arab action and solidarity, as well as establishing the best relations among Arab states in order to correct previous mistakes and build the future. Syria and Oman formed together a force for underlining the importance of a united Arab stance to overcome challenges facing our countries and peoples.
Oman has been working for years on alleviating tension between Arab countries, mainly with regards to Syria. He arrived in Damascus coming from Kuwait, where Arab foreign ministers were meeting. The significance of Oman's strategy towards Syria is that it did not sever its ties, as many Arab countries did during the crisis. The visit comes as Arab countries are gradually restoring relations with Syria following the victory of the country's government against terror. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Moving on to North America, where Mexico is suing major U.S. gun makers for fueling and profiting off the conflict south of the border. Now, 13 U.S. states and two Caribbean nations have thrown their weight behind the lawsuit. The unprecedented $10 billion lawsuit accuses the U.S. gun makers of knowingly facilitating the trafficking of weapons to drug cartels and leading to thousands of deaths. The lawsuit says over 500,000 U.S.-made guns are trafficked into Mexico every year. The companies argue that the sales are protected by the U.S. Constitution, but Mexico counters that the laws cannot be applied extraterritorially. Lawyers for Brazil, as well as Antigua and Barbuda, also say that U.S. gun manufacturers must not be permitted to hold hostage the law-abiding citizens of an entire region in the world. In 2017, a gunman opened fire on a mosque in Quebec City, killing six in the deadliest attack on a house of worship in Canada's history. During the 5 years since that incident, there have been several other instances of deadly attacks on minorities in Canada, particularly Muslims. Now, what's surprising is the high rate of anti-Muslim sentiment and Islamophobia that exists in the country, which boasts about its multiculturalism.
In January 2017, a Canadian man fatally shot six worshippers at the Quebec Islamic Cultural Center and seriously injured 19 others. Over the past 5 years, Muslim community members have pushed decision makers at all levels to denounce Islamophobia and put concrete measures in place to curb incitement and hate-fueled violence, including through stricter gun control laws. Also, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who immediately called the killings a terrorist attack on Muslims, has since faced criticism and calls to do more to stem Islamophobia. Those demands grew louder in the aftermath of a string of hate-fueled incidents, including an attack that left four members of a Muslim family dead in London, Ontario, last June. Also, in another hate crime incident, Canada's deadliest vehicle ramming attack happened in 2018, when a man plowed his van into a group of pedestrians in Toronto, killing 10 people. On Friday, the federal government announced in a statement that it intends to appoint a special representative to combat Islamophobia in Canada. But how effective would that be? Muslim Canadians are facing a sharp increase in violent hate crimes in public places and in places of work and worship. One example is the murder of Muhammad Aslim Zafis, who was killed outside a Toronto mosque in September 2020. Most recently, black Muslim women have also been disproportionately targeted by Islamophobic street harassment and assaults, particularly in Alberta. A report says in the last 5 years, more Muslims have been killed in targeted hate attacks in Canada than in any other G7 country. Also, over the past decade, police-reported hate crimes against Muslims in Canada have risen from 45 in 2012 to 181 in 2018. Now, on the fifth anniversary of the Quebec mosque shooting and the National Day of Action Against Islamophobia on January 29th, around a dozen Canadian Muslims are speaking out about experiences of Islamophobia in a new report from the charity Islamic Relief Canada. According to the report, many of those who've shared their experiences felt they were to be expected, living as a minority in Canada. The report also found that more women tended to be the targets of Islamophobia.
Based on reports, aggression against Canadian Muslims has increased following the 9/11 attacks that took place in the U.S. 20 years ago. And even more alarming is that in the last 5 years, more Muslims have been killed in targeted hate attacks in Canada than in any other G7 country. Islamophobia has now turned into a systematic problem for Canada.
A report by the National Council of Canadian Muslims stated that Muslims living in Canada have been increasingly facing anti-Muslim sentiments since the 9/11 attacks happened 2 decades ago in the U.S. The advocacy organization said Islamophobia is systemic in Canada and is evolving. The hate increased in the years immediately following the World Trade Center attack and has slowly grown since, with Statistics Canada reporting that anti-Muslim attacks numbered 99 in 2014, up from 36 in 2009. In 2015, hate crimes ballooned to 159, a 60% jump, and in 2017, incidents showed a dramatic increase to 349. Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Saturday said that Islamophobia is not acceptable at any cost and vowed to make his country safer for Muslims. But how successful has Trudeau been as a leader to address systemic Islamophobia as a major priority in Canada? Human rights advocates have criticized Trudeau's government for failing to meet its promise to deliver legislation to address hate crimes against minorities.
Now, the point is this, that this actually is not just as a result of 9/11. The level of Islamophobia around the world was actually very high even before 9/11.
Justin Trudeau had said while he is deeply opposed to Bill 21, which bars a range of public servants in roles of authority, including teachers, from wearing visible religious symbols, his government won't step into the legal challenge taking place in Quebec to avoid triggering a fight with the province over jurisdiction. In December 2021, an elementary school teacher in Quebec was told she could no longer teach in class because she wears a hijab, which is prohibited under Bill 21. That marks another failure for Trudeau as he falls short of condemning the bigotry against Muslims wearing symbols of their faith in his home province.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump vowed on Saturday, 29th of January, that Republicans in Congress would launch investigations targeting President Joe Biden and his family if the party retakes either the House or the Senate in this year's midterm elections. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist John Bowden, writing for The Independent. The piece is titled, Trump vows Republicans will retaliate for January 6 probe, investigate Biden if they retake Congress. Former U.S. President Donald Trump vowed on Saturday, 29th of January, that Republicans in Congress would launch investigations targeting President Joe Biden and his family if the party retakes either the House or the Senate in this year's midterm elections. The former president spoke in Texas on Saturday night, 29th of January, as he vowed retaliation for the ongoing investigation being carried out by the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th, as well as the fraud investigation into his company, the Trump Organization, led by New York's Attorney General Letitia James. When Republicans retake Congress, the Biden corruption will be investigated and exposed, Trump told a crowd of his fans, which roared its support in response. Of the House committee, he added later, "What the Unselect Committee is doing, it's a disgrace." His remarks were his second in just a few weeks, mentioning the ongoing investigation headed by Letitia James, who earlier this month unveiled the specific allegations of criminal activity her office is investigating. According to court filings, Letitia James's office believes the Trump Organization routinely misrepresented the values of its assets for tax purposes. Former president did not say what specific angle he thought GOP lawmakers would pursue in their hypothetical investigations into President Joe Biden, but he reiterated criticism of Hunter Biden's past work in Ukraine before Joe Biden took office, as well as the Biden family's other various business dealings. He also touted his support for Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, a Republican and loyal Trump supporter, and suggested that he take over the job of New York Attorney General Letitia James. "They want to put me in jail," Trump told a booing crowd. "This has been going on since I came down the escalator in Trump Tower 6 years ago." Donald Trump then once again faulted New York Attorney General Letitia James for her supposed political agenda centered around targeting him, pointing out her criticism of his business practices during her campaign for office. Letitia James's comments at the time came in response to well-reported accounts of the supposed criminal practices being employed by the Trump Organization, including congressional testimony from Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former attorney. House Republicans have vowed retaliation against Democrats, specifically in the form of measures to strip specific Democratic House members seen as favorite enemies of the GOP base, like Representatives Adam Schiff and Ilhan Omar, of their committee assignments if they retake power. GOP leaders have yet to make many specific threats about investigating Joe Biden himself, while far-right members of the House GOP caucus have been vowing his impeachment for months. Even if Republicans retake the House this November, the 6th of January committee has several months to complete its investigation, which has already revealed embarrassing and politically damaging insights into the events of the day when Donald Trump's supporters attacked the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. In the months ahead, the committee is expected to continue its investigation, which may escalate into criminal prosecution for allies of the former president just months before Americans are set to decide control of the House and the Senate. Meanwhile, a billionaire Republican donor and Donald Trump's supporter donated the maximum allowed amount to Senator Joe Manchin after the West Virginia Democrat sank Joe Biden's signature domestic spending plan. The Build Back Better plan sought to boost health and social care and to help combat the climate crisis at a price tag of $1.75 trillion. Senator Joe Manchin, one of two key swing votes in the 50-50 Senate, used the Fox News Channel's Sunday interview in December to say he was finally a no on the legislation. The move appeared to surprise President Joe Biden and enrage progressives, but Ken Langan was presumably delighted. The billionaire Republican donor and co-founder of Home Depot, Ken Langan, and author of a 2018 book called I Love Capitalism, had signaled his support for Senator Joe Manchin before the senator made his move on Build Back Better. "I don't see leadership anyplace in this country. Thank God for Joe Manchin," Ken Langan told CNBC in November. "I'm going to have one of the biggest fundraisers I've ever had for him. He's special, he's precious, and he's a great American."
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and let us ponder on an aphorism worth pondering upon from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. "He who gallops with loose rein collides with death."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in ar-rajim. Bismillahi ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen's aim and vision in life and his objective in life was to establish equality and equity and justice for all people and for the whole society. To the extent that he used to constantly look around, watch, walk in the markets of Kufa and make sure that everything is all right. So one day Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi paid a visit to one of his companions who seemingly had a big house. He was a wealthy man, obviously, so he had a bigger house. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he came in the house and he says to him, "Of what use to you is a spacious house in this world when you stand more in need of a spacious house in the hereafter, where you have to live eternally?" So obviously, Amir al-Mu'mineen trying to shift the man's attention that yes, you have money, yes, you have wealth, but you need to make sure that you spend it wisely and give most of it and give a portion of it at least to those who are less fortunate, those who are deprived. So the Imam trying to tell him that it's not in this world that you need to have a big house. It is in the hereafter. And why? Because the hereafter is eternal. This world will end. And me and you, wherever we earn, it will be taken from us, will be given to someone else. So we constantly want bigger houses, faster cars, this and that. And we want to live happy. But happiness is not meant to be in this world. The true happiness is in fact in the hereafter. Yes, we can have big houses. Yes, we can have all these things. But there are surely more things important. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he continues his debate or dialogue or discussion with this companion of his. And he says to him, "Of course, if you also desire a spacious house in the hereafter, then you should entertain guests in this house." So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given you a big house. You can have that big house in this world, and you can also have even a bigger house in the hereafter, considering that you use this house to serve and shelter people who are in need, to bring guests in, feed them, clothe them. If it's winter, bring them in, let them sleep, because a lot of people will sleep in the streets back in the day. And we still have that problem, which we call homelessness. So the Imam says to him, if you entertain guests in this house, behave well with the kinsmen. Don't act with pride and arrogance that you're rich and you have a bigger house and no one else does, and so on and so forth. And pay the right of others when it comes to homes and zakah on appropriate occasions. If you do so, you will be successful in this world and in the hereafter. So obviously Amir al-Mu'mineen is trying to say, yes, you can live up your life, have a bigger house, but considering there are other things that need to be done, that the house itself, you can use it for good work, and it does not become a point of pride, nor will it become a point where you divide yourself from people and you become class and they are below you. And obviously make sure that you are doing your Islamic duties by paying your taxes Islamically. Therefore, you will be successful in both worlds. Let us take a break, then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, Human Justice from the Perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi, one day he was having a discussion with his companion Kumail ibn Ziyad in regards to the importance of fasting and praying. He says to him, O Kumail, it is not important that you should offer prayers or observe fast and pay zakah. What is important is that you should offer prayers with a pure heart and in accordance with the desire of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, most of the times we do things, but we do them because we are forced to, not because we want to do them for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We don't have that pure heart and pure intention. So he says to him, while doing so, you need to think of others. You need to think of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala first and foremost. When it comes to praying, when it comes to giving zakah, prayer itself, it was meant to fix and rectify your behavior with people. Fasting is meant to make you feel the pain of other people. Zakah and charity and taxes is meant to make you give other people. So all these ibadat, they are for Allah's sake, but at the same time, they have a human connection to it as well. Even before the hereafter, he was so anxious about the life of the people in this world that in spite of him being the Khalifa, he used to go to the markets of Kufa as a matter of a daily routine. He stops at every shop and he says, O merchants, fear God, seek proximity to the customers, adorn yourself with the forbearance, don't swear, don't tell lies, avoid injustice, be just to the opposed and weigh and measure properly. Don't give the people lesser than the Jew. Don't spread corruption in the world. That was Amir al-Mu'mineen saying these words on a daily basis to the merchants and to the dealers and to the shop owners of the market of the Kufa. He is constantly trying to remind them that they need to be just. They need to be fair to the people that they live amongst. Because some of these merchants, some of these dealers, they take more profits, which puts people in a lot of hardship. And sadly, we still see the same things in our currently so-called modern world, where prices are so expensive that a lot of people can't afford the simple things. If it costs a company $1 to make, they sell for 20. And you can see that people in society are suffering because of this. Where Amir al-Mu'mineen used to come to these merchants on a daily basis and he tells them to be just and fair and create that sense of equality amongst people by becoming giving when it comes to measurement or coming to asking for profit to be fair and just. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله 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 صل على محمد وآله.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Beryl Carr is a special volunteer at a hospital in London. What makes her special, you might wonder? Well, the fact that she celebrated her 100th birthday last month. Carr has been volunteering in Ealing Hospital for more than 18 years. She works in the hospital's cafe and says her work is her lifeline. This incredible 100-year-old lady says she enjoys helping those who are not as fortunate as she is and that she has no intentions of retiring. The hospital staff say her presence has been very motivating.
And many of us look at her. She's always got a smile on her face, a swagger as she walks. And you come back from a clinic or a ward round, you're absolutely tired, and she just inspires you as soon as you see her.
Even the coronavirus pandemic has not stopped Carr from volunteering. Born in a nearby town, Carr says she moved back to the neighborhood more than two decades ago after the death of her husband. When asked about the secret to her long and healthy life, she refused to answer, saying she's not planning on revealing that secret. A surprise in a Chinese zoo ahead of the Lunar New Year. 15 rare golden tigers make debut in front of excited fans. A large group of visitors gathered in China's Yellow River Delta Zoo to watch the rare animals. This zoo is the largest breeding base for golden species of tigers across China. The animals are being strictly protected amid fear surrounding their extinction. The golden tigers are a variant of Bengali tigers with rare color variations, including black strips. They are no longer extant in the wild.
The most powerful telescope ever built in the world is now at its final destination in space. After traveling for nearly 1 month, NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has reached its final parking spot in space, which is approximately 1 million miles away from Earth. The mission of the tennis court-sized telescope is to explore the cosmos and better understand the early days of the universe. The $10 billion telescope will also carefully monitor faraway exoplanets and study the atmospheres of planets outside our solar system. It's more advanced than NASA's iconic Hubble telescope. The streets in the Taiwanese capital are decorated vividly to welcome the Year of the Tiger beginning on February the 1st. Residents are using tiger sculptures and totems to adorn the streets of Taipei. Shops are booming as people head out to buy special couplets ahead of the new year, also called the Spring Festival. Many are hoping they can completely defeat COVID-19 this year, as celebrations were scaled down due to the pandemic last year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated by almost 2 billion people across the world, though mainly in Asia. There are 12 animals representing each lunar year on the Chinese calendar. This year's zodiac is the tiger, a symbol of strength and power. A national zoo in Washington is now home to a new quill-covered resident, the second offspring of a porcupine family. Zoo staff reported the birth of the porcupet earlier this month during a snowstorm. They say they are awaiting a DNA analysis to reveal more information about the baby porcupine. Its brother is now 4 years old. The two siblings are the fourth generation of this family to live in the zoo's mammal house. These animals are born with the ability to climb and look almost identical until they are 6 months old. Natives of South America, these creatures are one of the 18 porcupine species that exist in the world today. The house in Colombia has become a hotspot for tourists. It's built in a unique way, and if you want to enter the house, you have to first walk on the ceiling leading to the door. The upside-down house is named Casa Loca and is located in Guatavita, a short distance from the capital, Bogota. tourists can be seen walking around taking pictures of this exceptional structure. Many say it fills them with joy to visit such places. Some tourists say this has provided them a chance to gain some relief from the struggles of the pandemic.
We've come from a pandemic. We've emerged from a lockdown. So this helps people have a moment of relaxation with the novelty that we did not have. You have fun while snapping photos. It puts your mind at ease.
The Austrian creator of Casa Loca says he first got the idea to build a house when he was visiting a similar place in his country back in 2015. He says his grandchildren were stunned by the creation, and that's why he decided to make an upside-down house in Colombia, where he lives now. He says people initially thought he was mad, but he decided to accomplish his plan anyway. The pandemic slowed him down a bit, but he proudly inaugurated the place 3 weeks ago.
Iran has won the first title in team category of the 20th Pan Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championship. Saman Kujuri has more.
Talented Iranian children have ranked first in team category of the 20th Pan Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships, which was held online. Children in five different age groups, including age 5 to 7 as Group A, 8 to 9 Group B, 10 to 11 Group C, 12 to 14 Group D, and 15 or older in Group E, annually attend the contest solving multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, cube root, fractions, time, and etc. 572 students from 21 member states participated at the event.
This year, Iranian students have won the title of Champion of the Champions in two categories. Moreover, they won titles in all categories, including Champion of Champions titles, Champion titles, First Winners, and the Second Winner titles. In 2023, Iran will host the 22nd edition of the Pan-Pacific Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Association Global Abacus and Mental Arithmetic Championships.
The Smart Kids Institute holds a national competition annually in August to select members of the Iranian team for attending the PALMA Global Abacus Championships. Children from 17 to 13 years of age take part in the competition to solve some 7 mathematical test sheets using abacuses.
I am 12 years old. I have won the first title in this round of the international competitions. I have been practicing with abacus for 4 years. In the competitions, we had to solve multiple math equations, including division, multiplication, square root, and etc.
My math teacher encouraged me to learn abacus 5 years ago. Abacus and mental arithmetic skills had great impact on my mental growth and helped me a lot in my math lessons.
The championship, organized by a non-profit organization established in 1999, is an example of what can be achieved with early intervention in abacus math and mental arithmetic education.
The purpose of the competition is to allow for observation of mental arithmetic skills from countries around the world and to promote related education to find new talents in this field. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Traveling around the world is a wish a lot of people have, but never actually get the chance. However, the Belgian-British girl has achieved that feat at only 19. Zora Rutherford flew back home on Thursday to a crowd made up of family members, friends, fans, and journalists. She completed her odyssey after just over 5 months, traveling over 52,000 kilometers. Zora is the youngest female in the world to fly around the globe. She achieved this using a microlight aircraft, which weighs only 325 kilograms and has very low fuel consumptions. That's absolutely amazing. Let's take a listen.
Right, the plane obviously is a bad for the environment. I'm not trying to claim that it is. But I have chosen one of the best aircraft to do it with. The fuel consumption is amazing. For this whole trip, it's used the same amount of fuel as a Boeing uses in about 10 minutes for the whole trip around the world, which I think puts things into perspective. Obviously, it is bad, but I'm really trying to minimize my impact as much as possible.
Zara says the scariest part of her trip was flying over the frozen expanse of Siberia, a place with no human habitation close by. The teen adventurer also had to deal with different countries' health restrictions. Zara had to take multiple PCR tests on her journey, while China's COVID-related regulations meant she could not use the country's airspace. Now, Zara says she is glad she can stay in one place for a few months. Who knows what her next adventure will be? In the world of art, a Japanese artist named Sachi is creating incredibly realistic felted wool portraits of cats. Sachi calls her artworks Wakuneko, which directly translates to frame cat. Her work is highly popular, and she has more than 600,000 followers on different social media platforms. Each portrait takes a whopping 1 month to complete. The crafting process starts with Sachi looking at dozens of photos of the cat she wants to replicate. Then she prepares the required materials before preparing the foundation and mounts the felt onto it. The most difficult part of the job is making the subject's eyes. According to Sachi, it is also the most special stage.
I think that the moment when the cat's spirit enters into the artwork can be presented through the eyes. In that sense, I have been very particular about how to make the eyes.
Sachi's portraits have inspired people around the world to adopt homeless cats. Now she hopes to hold an exhibition showing various cats, including ones with physical handicaps, in order to inspire more adoptions of shelter cats.
The Indian-administered Kashmir has the world's only floating post office, a 200-year-old houseboat, and a famous Dal Lake in Srinagar. Set up during the British rule in India, the post office has survived throughout the years because of its charm. Our correspondent Shahanabad has more.
The Indian-administered Kashmir was once a princely independent state, out of bounds for outsiders. As the ruler of Jammu and Kashmir disallowed non-locals to own property in this picturesque region. During the British rule in the Indian subcontinent, many Britons tried to find an alternative way of living in Kashmir. Thus, houseboat on the world-famous Dal Lake came into existence. Today, the lake is a home to hundreds of such boats, which are a major attraction for tourists around the globe. This one is a unique boat, the only floating post office in the whole world. This is a 200-year-old boat built by the British. It has truly stood the test of time, as it still functions.
Post office, Dal Lake.
This is not an ordinary post office. We're standing on a heritage property. I've enjoyed my work since the very first day I came here. It's a unique experience to be working here. And every day, I get the chance to meet people from different corners of the world.
The boat is not limited to postal services. It also has a small museum where colorful stamps from the 1980s are put to display, along with a collection of rare philately stamps. The post office is a hot tourist destination in the region. Locals also come to this post office to send postcards to their loved ones, inviting them to visit Kashmir.
Floating post office.
In the age of technology, electronic mails, e-cards and other internet applications have made it extremely easy for people to communicate. But sending a postcard from this floating post office gives one a really different feeling.
The floating post office underwent reconstruction in 2011 and is currently a part of the Indian postal system. Recently, the office started offering banking services, thus attracting more locals.
I have opened an account here for my daughter. It's hassle-free and this place suits my mind. It's not like the usual offices. Visiting this place with kids is like a trip.
Yet another attraction of this post office is this souvenir shop, from where everyone can buy postcards, stamps, traditional crafts and greeting cards.
This floating post office in Kashmir's Dal Lake is like a time machine. It brings people back to 2 centuries ago and shows them the history of the beautiful region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Findings from a pilot study involving 36 patients raised the possibility that COVID may cause microscopic damage to the lungs that is not detected using routine tests. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Hannah Devlin and Nicola Davis. The piece is titled Long COVID Study Finds Abnormality in Lungs That Could Explain Breathlessness. Abnormalities have been identified in the lungs of long COVID patients that could offer a potential explanation for why some people experience breathlessness long after their initial infection. The findings from a pilot study involving 36 patients raised the possibility that COVID may cause microscopic damage to the lungs that is not detected using routine tests. Breathlessness is a symptom in the majority of long COVID patients, but it has been unclear whether this is linked to other factors such as changes in breathing patterns, tiredness, or something more fundamental. According to Dr. Emily Fraser, a consultant at Oxford University Hospital and a co-author of the study, the latest findings are the first evidence that underlying lung health could be impaired. Dr. Emily Fraser said, "It is the first study to demonstrate lung abnormalities in people with long COVID, who are breathless and where other investigations are unremarkable. It does suggest the virus is causing some kind of persistent abnormality within the microstructure of the lungs or in the pulmonary vasculature." She added more work would be required to clarify the clinical significance of the findings, including how the apparent abnormalities relate to breathlessness. Claire Steeves, a clinical senior lecturer at King's College London who was not involved in the study, said the findings would be of significant interest to anyone living with long-term breathlessness after COVID. She said they suggest that the efficiency of the lung in doing what it is meant to do, exchange carbon dioxide and oxygen, may be compromised, even though the structure of the lung appears normal. Adding, "However, we really need to await the completion of the study to know whether these early findings are robust, and if so, how much they explain and what the ramifications are in terms of potential treatments."